This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, mobile web development, coffee, BMWs, and minivans. This is episode number 77. Today is Monday, May 14th, 2012. We have two lovely sponsors we would like to say thanks to at the start of the show. The first one is Rackspace, and the second one is Hover.com. Tell you more about those guys as the show continues, just like we always do, and I hope you listen. We also want to say thanks very much to my friend and yours, creator of the amazing artwork and logos and such that you see here on the 5x5.tv website and in the shows, Jory Raphael. He has a little thing out called Symbolicons.com, where he makes these amazing vector shapes and artwork, and he is sponsoring Bandwidth for 5x5, so go check him out, Symbolicons.com. Good morning, Marco Arment.
Good morning, Daniel Benjamin.
The founder of Instapaper.com.
I think we're past the .com stage now. I think we can
just say Instapaper.
That. Like .com, it sounds like it's like keywords on AOL now. It's like, right. Of course, it's you know.
Hashtag Instapaper on Twitter.
It's like when people tell you their Twitter username and they say the @.
They do. You know people do that? Oh, I'm @. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm @ Dan Benjamin. Yeah, it sounds weird. Anyway, I got a lot to cover today, so let's get to it.
Let's do it. Let's hit it up.
Yeah.
Topic number one.
Yeah, that's how I sound. All right, so we got.
We need a little soundboard so you can slam, you know, like Kramer. You just slam like a, and you hear like a wolf howling when it, you know, or something like that.
I was thinking about about having a soundboard on my side of the audio and just not telling you, and just right. throwing in like an occasional, like, you know, like an animal, you know, some kind of sound, and just to see if you notice. So someday I might do that just to keep you on your toes, and I won't tell you before I do it.
All right, thank you.
No problem. The really funny part would be if, you know, to have a soundboard of my clips and just see if you can even tell the difference.
Just when you hit anyway,
BMW.
Right, exactly.
That's right. I like
Please
it.
Please don't email me.
Yeah.
I could be doing it now. You don't even know.
That's right. Or I, yeah, and if you're ever sick, I could just run that.
Yeah.
You know, have some pre-recorded clips.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure you can hook up some kind of like Markov chain generator to put them right. together in a way that might kind of make sense.
Yeah.
All right. So last show, we talked about a number of things. One of them was job listings that big companies make with all these ridiculous requirements that nobody really satisfies. I got a really good feedback from Charles Irwin, who said, one additional thing to consider for people applying to jobs, especially at big companies, is that most everything they probably has their own custom cruft. As such, there will always be some learning curve when coming into those positions. It fits in well with discussions on Hypercritical and BNA with respect to learning APIs versus learning programming languages. You'll have to spend more time figuring out whatever custom libraries and APIs the company has in use, in the same way you'd have to spend more time learning core data APIs than basics of Objective-C. That's a very good point. I mean, anytime any programmer goes into a new job where there's an existing code base that you're working on, you have to learn the code base. And that always comes with a learning curve.
Right.
I mean, I think a ballpark might be like, you know, from the first day a new programmer's on the job until they're producing more than they're costing you effectively in time usually.
Yeah.
Usually that's a period of a few weeks, possibly up to a few months, especially like if they're younger. If you hire somebody right out of college, you know, unless they're Linus Torvalds or however he says his name in whatever context, I know, please email Dan all those quotes.
Yes, please do. Please. Not.
Whenever Mr. Torvalds, you know, if he applied for a job, you know, right out of college, I assume he went to college. I think he was doing Linux in college. Anyway, I don't know. Please email Dan. But if you have a rock star programmer, which, oh man, I hate that term too. All right. If you have somebody ridiculously good, they might have a short learning curve right out of college. But most people, you know, if you're hiring a fresh graduate, it's probably going to be like 3 months before you're really coming out ahead with that hire. Now, the advantage is you can train them and you can kind of mold them into the kind of programmer you want, especially when they're so young and inexperienced and they haven't had enough time to get really stubborn yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's always going to be like a period of time where you're not yet productive in a new job, in a new context. And, you know, you have the same thing when you're learning a new language. And I think it's roughly the same amount of time. You know, if you're going somewhere with an existing code base, you know, that's a lot to learn. And that's just as much to learn as, yeah, like as an API. And an API is more to learn than a language. So I think we're talking about the same ballpark of things here. So yeah, that's a very good point. Thanks, Charles. Now I want to talk about, first of all, let's talk about the 5x5 radio app launch. I mean, there's not that much to say, is there? But I think it's important, you know, that you launched it. It's out. 5x5 radio is out, and you can go download it for $3 or some other quantity of bucks if you're outside of the U.S. And
it's yeah. 18 pence if you're not in the U.S. or $2.99 if you are.
The longest text string currency is I believe it's the Swiss franc or something. Okay. Or it's abbreviated CHF. I think that's yeah. Oh God, I'm such an idiot. I'll ignore that subject as well. All right. So yeah, how is it going for you?
It's going great. You know, a lot of people have downloaded it, and it's doing very, like, it's showing up as new in the store. And I mean, it's way, way, way.
Well, it is new.
Yes, it is. It is new. I'm blown away, to be honest. I'm just, I don't know what to say. So many people are downloading it and have so many nice things to say about it. I couldn't have possibly imagined it having this strong of a launch. I'm really just blown away by everybody. So thank you for everybody.
Have you added to your house since the launch?
Well, you know, we wanted to do a conversion. We wanted to convert the garage into a media room. So that's begun. And it was a two-story house. It's a four-story house now.
Right. Now, wait a minute. But if you're losing your garage, where are the two M5s going to go?
We have a subterranean garage being put in right now.
Oh, okay. That
which is hard because the Texas clay or whatever it is, but we'll figure it out. They'll get it done.
Good.
No, I mean, it really is huge. It's really great. And I couldn't be happier, couldn't be more surprised. And this obviously means, that people like it and people want to do it. And, you know, of course we want to do things. There is a bug in there that we've already fixed and we've already submitted for it, that basically it had to do with, I guess it, according to Tim Arnold, who's the guy, by the way, hire this guy, don't hire him when he's working on my stuff, but Tim Arnold, and I'll put a link to, can I put him into the show notes?
Sure.
All right. I'll put him in there, but it's timarnold.org. He's the guy that built this thing with me. But he says there was a problem with Coco's date formatter, which is parsing the upcoming show date and times, and it only occurred in non-US locales. So some people who are not in the US were experiencing a bug where it might crash when they would launch it. Anyway, we fixed it. We submitted it as soon as Apple, gets hold of it and says okay to it, that fix will be out there. So that's
cool.
That's it.
That's great. Yeah.
And, so, you know, already a bug, right?
These days, we're getting a pretty consistent, like, 6 to 7 day review time on all apps in the store from what I've heard and what I've seen myself. I have a pending update myself because my big 4.2 came out and
yeah.
A few big bugs. So I fixed them. And
then that suck, though? I mean, I'm finally getting, like, a taste of what you guys have been having to deal with all along of just, oh, there's a bug, and we fixed it right away, but we're just waiting.
Right, see?
Yeah, it sucks.
See, I had a baby, you launched an app.
Right, right.
We're now really in each other's worlds.
That's right. Yeah. And I descaled the Keurig over the weekend, so super.
Wow, that's great. It's so bizarre that that's even necessary to me. Like, I clean my teapot, and I clean my mug, and I clean the AeroPress.
You don't have the hard water?
No, actually, my water is right in the middle. Like, we had it, the house inspector pH tested it when we bought the house, and it's like, I think 7 is a neutral pH, right? It's like, it's right in the middle of the neutral range, and or whatever. Maybe hardness is not pH. It's probably on a different scale. But it's like right in the middle of the hardness scale, so we don't need to do anything to it. Which is awesome.
So I put my Keurig, because I know there are a lot of Keurig fans.
I hate rinsing soap off my hands on the West Coast. Is it because the water's too soft and there's no,
I don't know,
like lime in there to get the soap off your hands? It's the West Coast, and when I took a trip to Phoenix, Arizona.
I love Phoenix.
A couple of years ago, and it was the worst there. The water, like, you couldn't rinse your hair in the shower. Every time I'd go to the bathroom and wash my hands would just be covered in like soap film. It was disgusting.
Are you sure that wasn't the hotel? Maybe because hotel water can be weird.
Well, I was staying in a house.
Oh, well, there you go.
But I stayed in two different houses and they both have the same problem.
Maybe your skin needs to adapt. I'll have to ask Merlin that. I don't know how. Maybe that's what Merlin is. Always looks homeless or old.
And whenever I go to San Francisco for the WWDC, I have a similar problem there, but it's not as bad. But I've also only ever stayed in the Intercontinentals. Maybe it's just them.
Yeah.
But I don't know. This year I'm at the W, so I'll see if it's different there.
The W is great. I've stayed there at least three times, I think, and I don't remember that being as much of a problem. Plus, they have the really great soap there. Really great soap.
Yeah, that's great.
Oh, yeah. Wait till you get there. A little very fancy.
I'll do a full review of the soap when I get there.
The hallways are very dark. Cool music playing at all times. It's always midnight in the W in San Francisco.
Awesome.
So I put the Keurig B60.
I hope I go to Jim's party. I don't think I've received an invitation
special
yet.
Special edition into the show notes, Marco, in case you want to pick one up.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, you didn't get an invite? Right, he asked how of course he's sick today, Jim.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, I don't know if he's listening.
No, I didn't get an invite, but it sounds cool, like with the karaoke band. That sounds like a really cool idea. So Jim, I want to go to your party.
Yeah.
All right. Last week we talked a lot about Instacast because they just that morning unveiled their 2.0 release, and it had this controversial in-app purchase mechanism where they actually, I'll get to that in a minute, but I got feedback from a guy whose name is pronounced Owen Hayes, and it's spelled not at all like that, but he says it's Irish. He says, Marco sounds like something of an edge case in terms of podcast listeners. How many people need variable speed playback per podcast? And more to the point, I think he's being a little harsh on Instacast's depth of navigation. In my experience, everyone seems to have their own granular podcast setup, which is difficult to capture without burying some settings. Now, the second half of that question answers the first half of that question. I never did this before because I always was using the built-in player. I love having variable speed preferences per podcast because, of course, I would never 2X one of your shows.
No, gosh, why? No. Who? Never.
But like for instance, I told you, I listened to Howard Stern with my wife when we're doing stuff around the house, and she hates anything faster than 1X. She hears the artifacts and they drive her crazy. So I can't listen to things with her faster than 1X. And since I usually listen to Howard Stern with her, I just have that one set to 1X always. But when I'm out walking the dog or doing errands, I like to listen faster. So the shows that I listen to that she doesn't listen to, I keep on higher speed settings. I really enjoy 1.5X, by the way. That's like my new go-to setting for if I want to speed it up. 2X is a little bit crazy. But anyway, I love that feature personally. And I believe Instacast has added that in 2.0. I admit I haven't tried Instacast 2.0 yet. I just haven't had time yet. But Downcast had that before, and I love that feature. I use it all the time. But, the second half of his question illustrates why podcast apps are so complicated, because everybody does want different things out of them. Mm-hmm. Everyone has different ways they listen, different feature needs and wants. And it's just very... I don't know. It's a very personal thing. It's a lot like to-do apps. There's a million to-do apps out there because that's the kind of thing that everyone has their own custom needs of what they want, and everyone wants the simplest app possible. They don't want any weird cruft. They want things to be simple and clean, but they want these 17 features. And five of those are not common requests. So that's why there's a million to-do apps and why the market for to-do apps will never go away. Clear came out not too long ago into a market that everyone thought was done because of Things and OmniFocus and a few other ones. But there's infinite potential there because you can make any to-do app and it'll be the perfect app for some small segment of people. And the thing is, a lot of people need a to-do app. So it's a massive potential market. Your app, whatever you make, will appeal to a very small sliver of it. But it's just such a big market, and there's infinite demand for different to-do apps because most people who use a to-do app are about 80% satisfied with it. You know, they're willing to jump to a new one if one comes better, or they like to try a bunch of different ones because they have the obsession with tools and procedures that Merlin hates so much. But that's a very common thing. So, you know, it's similarly podcasting apps. I think there's always going to be a market for new podcasting apps because not quite as severe as to-do apps, but they're the kind of thing where everyone has their own little preferences and ways they want things to work. And I don't think that's ever going to go away because it is not possible to make the perfect podcast app for everybody because people's needs and wants conflict with each other. So there's always going to be this market. And so, you know, what I don't like about Instacast or what I didn't like about Instacast 1, everyone else seems to like just fine. So who cares? You know, all I'm saying is what I like and what I use and why I use it. So I still use Downcast. I still like it. I do want to try Instacast 2.0, but I haven't yet. And I want to talk about paid upgrades. And I'll come back to Instacast in a minute. But paid upgrades were a big topic on Hypercritical and on Amplified this past week. And we've talked about them before, paid App Store upgrades in particular. We've talked about it before. And, you know, I think the consensus so far is that this is something that is going to happen, that Apple is going to give us paid upgrades in the Mac and iOS app stores. It's just a matter of time. They just haven't gotten to it yet. But I'm starting to think that maybe
you're convinced of that, though. I mean,
what I'm saying. I'm actually thinking that's not the case.
Oh,
I previously thought that was the case, but the more I think about it, the more I think that the omission of paid upgrades is deliberate. It's that they've actually decided this is the better way to do it, and here's why. So, if you look at the app stores today, the status quo. The method of getting software and updating it is very, very simple. You buy an app, then you always have it. You can always re-download it at any time. By the way, there is one little exception to that. When you submit an update to an app, it asks you, since last summer with the Lodsys issue, Apple started asking, whenever you submit an update, are you updating this app because of a legal issue? And it doesn't really clarify that much further. It just says, are you updating it because of a legal issue? And I think if you say yes, it removes it from the ability to be re-downloaded later onto people's devices. I think. I would love to get clarification from that from somebody who has tried this before. But I think that's why they ask that. Because if there's a legal issue with an app, you don't want people to be able to re-download it after you've pulled it off the store, you know, even if they bought it. I think that's what the checkbox is for. I'd love to hear feedback from anybody who can confirm that. Anyway, but for the most part, with that one exception, once you buy an app, you have it, and you can re-download it forever, and you can update it forever. And that's important because the method of updating is, you know, the App Store screen comes up, and it says you have 8 updates available, and you click update all, and that's it. It goes through all of them and updates them all. There's not much downside to that. You know, you get all the updates automatically, and everything's free, and that's it. You know, you hit update all, and you don't really have to care that much. There is the case where updates make an app worse for you, and that's kind of bad. But I could also argue that, you know, I mean, web apps are always like that. A web app, you can't control when they update. It updates for you on their servers behind the scenes. Yeah. And we've gotten along with that just fine as an industry for years now. And you know, people will occasionally complain, like they complain whenever Facebook changes anything, but too bad. You know, if you want to keep using it, here's the new version, and that's all you get. And for the most part, it isn't really a problem. You know, the world hasn't ended because Facebook changed their layout. Although I really don't like that new time. I don't understand that timeline thing. But maybe it's because I don't use Facebook enough to really get it. I don't know. So, you know, the status quo, you update your apps, you always have the most recent versions for the most part. You know, you can hold on to an old version, but it's such a pain in the butt that almost nobody does because it's just so much easier to just hit update all every time that comes up. So for the most part, you're forced to update. You're forced to keep up to date effectively. But it doesn't really matter. There's no real downside to that. Now, imagine what would happen if they bolted on paid upgrades to the system that we have. The biggest thing is that you can't, I mean, at least you shouldn't, be able to force people to pay for something. You know, you can't you can't force people to pay to keep using your app. I mean, you can kind of fake it with an app purchase, but Apple doesn't like that very much. And, you know, for the most part, you can't force it. You know, you can force a free update effectively by releasing it, and then people will be forced to use it eventually. But a paid upgrade, you can't force that on somebody. So what happens to a paid upgrade if it comes up in the App Store? If you didn't want to pay, would it just sit in the updates tab forever? But that kind of sucks. You know, that's an interface problem. It makes this weird clunky thing where you can no longer update all. You know, do they add a separate section for paid updates? Then that adds more cruft to the interface. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's all these considerations for the interface. It'll make it a lot less simple. What if it's a paid upgrade? Fine. But what if it fixes a really big bug in a previous version? So this week we had the Adobe Photoshop and Illustrator, I believe, the CS5 TIFF image security hole, which it's a pretty critical security vulnerability where you can open up a maliciously crafted TIFF file and it's remote code execution. It's a pretty big problem. So it's a vulnerability in CS5, and initially Adobe said, basically, we're not going to fix this in CS5. It's fixed in CS6. Buy the upgrade if you want the fix. And this was a pretty crappy move, you know, because it's widely accepted practice in the software industry that security updates should be free for a pretty long time after a product is sold. You know, you can stop issuing feature updates, and that's fine. But if you find a big security vulnerability in a product that's only 2 years old, generally you patch that and it's a free update. So eventually, in response to the criticism, Adobe did say, all right, fine, we will indeed patch this in CS5. So that's good. But regardless, so...
But it was really weird the way that they came out with this. And I'll put I have a link about this from Macworld. But it was just strange because they announced that they wouldn't be updating it after... It was announced that there were, you know what I'm saying? Like that's the wrong kind of response. But
yeah,
the Macworld says, according to an Adobe spokesperson, quote, the team decided to make available patches for Photoshop CS5.x, Illustrator CS5.x, and Flash Professional CS5.x.
Well, I'm glad the team decided that.
Right. The time frame, yeah, they were not influenced by any external factors.
Let's do it anyway.
They woke up, felt good about it. The time frame for availability of those fixes is unclear. Quote, we are still in the process of finalizing the timeline for these patches. The spokesperson said, quote, we will update the respective security bulletins once the patches are available. There's the best way to learn about this is by following the Adobe Product Security Incident Response Team blog, which I will put into the show notes.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah.
Oh, and I did just, David Smith in the chat did just clarify that the updating this app because of a legal issue checkbox is indeed to prevent people from downloading older versions of the app from restores or download. So yeah, that is what that's for. So with paid upgrades, if they added this to the App Store, you would first have, you know, if they just bolted it onto the current system, you would have the issue with you can't hit update all anymore. You can't force people to update. They could have this one update for your app sitting in their updates tab forever if they didn't want to pay for it. The other thing is then you wouldn't be able to issue these security or bug fix updates to the previous version without them paying. So that kind of sucks too. You know that's two big things that suck about this. To solve that problem. That wouldn't solve the interface problem, but to solve the versions and security updates problem, what you would effectively need would be something like a branch structure of versions in iTunes Connect, in the management interface to the app, so that you could say, okay, this new version of my app is a paid update to version 1.x, and version 1.x will still be its own tree. But then you'll have to market so that people can't buy version 1.x anymore if they're new customers, but old customers can still restore it. And it adds a lot of complexity here to the interface, to iTunes Connect, to the management of all these apps, to the supporting staff at Apple that has to manage these apps and deal with people managing these apps. It's a lot of complication. And then it's complicated for users because as people have talked about on your other shows, people who have always bought software you know, box software for their computers generally have an idea of paid upgrades and how that works. But people who just have their iPhones and iPads and haven't really been pro software customers before, they might not realize how common this practice of paid upgrades is in the old software world. They might just assume, hey, you know, I paid for this, I should keep getting it.
Like, I mean, isn't it weird just to think, an update? It's weird to think for people like us, who've been around for so long dealing with regular software, that for a lot of people, an iOS device that they have might be their first real computer. It might be their first experience buying and paying for software. I mean, that's a weird concept.
And even if it isn't, it at least might be their first computer for which they have wanted to buy software for. You know, the first computer that they weren't just handed from work because they had to have one, or that, like, you know, their computer friend convinced them to get, and they just go on Facebook and they never launch anything besides Internet Explorer. Like, it does go beyond that. So it's a lot of people who are in this app market who don't know about paid upgrades and who probably wouldn't respond very well to that.
Yeah.
You know, the same people who get really upset when Facebook changes their login form. You know, so adding this onto the App Store would be a significant complication in lots of ways. And I think it would make customers, not us developers, but it would make customers less happy with the App Store overall. And Apple does not want that. And as developers, we really don't want that either. I mean, we really shouldn't want that because that's not good for us. So it's really not a very good solution. As much as it sucks for people for developers who are used to this as the way we do business, it has a lot of downsides, especially in the context of what the App Store is and how it works today. And I don't think Apple really wants to change how it works very dramatically. So, you know, right now, today, with all the abilities we have now, the only thing you can really do is you can submit an entirely separate app, like Tweety 2, you know, it's a whole different app, call it version 2 or whatever, charge separately for it, make everybody pay a new price for it, which means the pricing has to be pretty low, otherwise people won't like that very much, and that's your new version. Or you use an app purchase, and you have some other way, and I don't necessarily know if the Instacast way to do it was a very good idea, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but you have some other way to make more money in the app, whether it's selling a feature, selling a service, selling a subscription, selling more content, more levels for a game, et cetera, whatever it is. I think Apple's message to us, I mean, I don't know if they're going to add paid upgrades, but I think Apple's message to us so far is that they're not going to make paid upgrades easy because presumably they don't think it's the right strategy. And that if you want more money after the fact, use an app purchase somehow. I really think that's their message, and that's at least the implied message so far. And I just don't see that changing, because paid upgrades really are problematic. When you really think about how they would be implemented, all the real world solutions and problems that would come up as a result of them, like in the current App Store ecosystem, I don't see it happening. I just don't.
But clearly it is something that is important. It is something that needs to be addressed. What are they going to do about this? The Apple has to do something about it.
I'm very curious to see what Apple does with their own apps in the App Store. You know, what do they do with the iWork apps? What do they do with Aperture and Final Cut and Logic? It's all in the App Store, right? Like, what I'm really curious to see what they do with that when they have major new versions of those apps, assuming Aperture ever gets a major new version, which is not a safe assumption by any means. What do they do when that happens? My guess is the reason they've lowered prices with all these App Store versions of these pro apps is because they don't really care about upgrade pricing anymore in the App Store, and they think this is the right way to go. And my guess is when the new apps come out, the old ones disappear off the store, and the new ones are just the new app, and you have to rebuy the entire thing at full price to get it. And that's kind of the message we're sending developers, is if you really want major new versions of apps, do that. Otherwise, use an app purchase for things. So I'm really curious what they're going to do here. I really don't think paid upgrades are coming. I really don't. So,
all right. That's depressing.
Talk about Instacast, or you want to do a sponsor first?
Yeah, let's do a sponsor first. This is a sponsor that they've been with us for a short time, and they've got such a great response, and it makes perfect sense why, because they're a really great service. I told you about them last week, but they wanted to continue offering this special deal for the listeners. So we've got them back this week, hover.com. And I think the easiest way for you to think about Hover is that it's simplified domain name management. That's what I talked about last week. You want to register a domain name, you go to hover.com. You want a .com, you want a .net, whatever it is that you want. They have all the little TLDs that you could come up with. You go there, you type it into the search box, done. That's it. Is your domain name available? Yes. You want the .com, check the box, hit submit, you're done. If you don't want the .com or if it's taken, they have all the other TLDs that are right there. It shows you what's available. If those are taken, it'll come up, start making up suggestions for you. It'll have, you know, some kind of thing that it is like a computer brain or something behind the scenes where it comes up with actually pretty cool domain. How do they do that? Is there a computer? I don't know. It's a mystery. This is part of their secret. They don't want me to say. But you go there and you fill out the thing, you've got a domain name. They don't upsell you on stuff. They don't give you all kinds of crazy offers and promos. You don't have to unsubscribe to things. You don't have to vote. They just want the experience to be straightforward. You get in, you get out, and in a year they tell you your domain name is going to expire. And that's it. And they're out of your way. Clean, simple, straightforward. Transfer, super easy. They'll even do the transfer for you if you can't be hassled with that. If you don't mind, they have tutorials that explain how to get your domain from, I won't even name the other places, but they have a tutorial that walks you through all of them. Renewals, just as easy. And they do email hosting. I don't know how long they've been doing that, if it's been part of the thing all along, because I've been telling you about it too. It's something I'm checking out. You might want to check it out as well. Because I want to move away. I want to move all my email hosting to a paid service. So I'm looking at these guys for this now. Email your own domain. So anyway, hover.com, and here's the coupon code to use. Dan sent me. It will get you 10% off anything you do over there.
They really are great. I told you, I mean, I'm moving all my domains over there that I can move over there, which I think is pretty much everything except preview.fm, because they don't do FMs yet.
I know, but they don't.
So about
Hover guys, please start doing FM so I can move 5x5.fm there. I'm ready to get it. I need them to do it.
All right. So last week, you know, Instacast released this 2.0 update, and they included this fairly controversial in-app purchase for some of the new features. And there was a lot of backlash.
And confusion around this, too, about what exactly, had they taken something away?
Right.
It turns out they didn't use the app, so I didn't realize this yet.
They took away an old feature. And now they have a version 2.0.1 in review right now. That looks like it says smart playlists are now available for free. So if that was the only feature they really took away, then it looks like they're reverting that decision, which is probably a good sign. But whatever the case may be, there were features that were available before that now require the in-app purchase. And that's a really tough sell for a lot of people. That's tough to swallow. And in addition to that, you know, it kind of violated people's expectations in the App Store of everything always being updated for free, because a lot of the new features required the in-app purchase to really get. So, but at the same time, they have a very loyal audience of lots of very happy customers who didn't think it was a big deal. So if you look at their rankings, so before the show, I checked the numbers, and they have an average.
How is this that you're checking these numbers?
In this wonderful app called iTunes that everyone loves. It's currently a 3.5 star average in the US store.
Okay.
They have 190 five-star reviews and 92 one-star reviews. So it's almost 2-to-1 ratio. And that's very good that's a lot of five-star and almost none in the middle, you know, of course, because the five-star review system is really stupid. They might as well just have 5 and 1. I mean, that's effectively all they have. This is almost 2-to-1, 5-star to 1-star. And so what this is showing, they do have lots of very happy customers. And you know, the very strong happy fans are propping it up with those 5-star reviews, but that's a lot of 1-stars. That's a pretty big ratio of 1-star reviews for a good app to have, and it is a very good app. So that has to be disturbing. You know, if you only have a handful of 1-star reviews, like, you know, most good apps, every app is going to get 1-star reviews because, you know, a lot of people just. People don't realize, or they don't care, you know, that if the app doesn't do exactly what they want, it doesn't mean it's a 1-star app. To me, 1-star means like it doesn't work, and you know, the 1-star to me means this shouldn't have even gotten through app review. But that's not how it, that's not what it means to most people. One star means that they think that their comment deserves a lot of attention from the developers. That's what really what one star means to the population. So, but, you know, you can ignore a few one star reviews, but you can't ignore this many. This is a lot to have that be, you know, half of your five star review quantity. That's a lot. And you just can't sit back and ignore that. And I mean, really, you know, the one-star review, it's kind of extortion.
Oh, it's really horrible. And I mean, really...
It's bad.
We've talked about it here. It stays there forever. You know, that one-star review will affect the fate of that app for the life of the app. Unless you get rid of that and release an entirely separate version. Not an upgrade, not an update, but like a whole new version. Right. That review will stay there, and if people decide to mark it as helpful, it will stay at the top. You know, I mean, and I guess people think that's you know, that's funny or that's a neat way. I'm not talking about the people who really really don't get it and who are just sort of casual computer users, but I'm talking about the people who use it in an intentional way to like, I'm going to get Marco's attention.
Right. It's, I mean, it really is. A lot of the comments really are extortion. Yeah. It's like. It's like, I'm going to keep this one star until you add this feature that I want, and then I'll update my review. Like, my useless mug, that's serious. Like, people seriously write that way. Like, one star, this is a completely useless app, even though I use it every day, but it just misses this one little feature that I kind of want. One star until you add it. You know, it's a real dick move, but there's nothing we can do about it, right? As developers, there's nothing we can do about it. We can't even respond. You know, there's just nothing you can do. So, you know, it's not really worth worrying that much about, you know, how do we prevent people from leaving one-star reviews? It's just cost of doing business. People will leave one-star reviews, and many of them won't really be valid. Many of them won't be fair. If they say something that's wrong, that's factually wrong, you can use that little, like, dispute this review button or report a concern. And I've heard that Apple does occasionally respond to those and take down bad reviews that are just, like, factually wrong or that are just, like, trolling, that don't really contain any content that's relevant or anything like that. But I don't think they get removed very often. So, you know, let's talk about Instacast a little bit more. There's a lot here. So, you know, and one thing also to think about, this is one thing I missed last week. A good point from Peter. Oh my God. Ukchitil? I don't know.
Ukchitil.
I'm sorry. Regarding Instacast new pricing, one thing I dislike about in-app purchases is that I can't gift the complete app to someone. As far as I know, there's no mechanism to gift an in-app purchase. I love Instacast, but gifting it now feels lame because the recipient will have to pay more money to get the whole app. That's something I never really thought about, but that's totally true. That really is that's a valid concern for, you know, if you're doing this approach of splitting up your app's features and having some of them be available via in-app purchase and some of them with the purchase price. That is indeed a legitimate concern, and I just hadn't thought about that. But I want to talk about in general. I want to talk about removing features because I've done it myself. You know, a lot of apps are better when they remove features. So there's good reasons and bad reasons to remove a feature. I think the good reason really is, like, you know, if the app really is going to be better without that feature. So I've done this before with my app. One of the biggest things I removed was RSS folders. This was a feature I added way back in version 2.0 in like 2008 or 2009. Yeah, 2009, I think. I added this feature of RSS folders where you could just make a folder that was an RSS feed and it would automatically download all the articles from that feed, or at least the most recent 10. It was a horrible feature for so many reasons. It confused what the app did. It slowed down updates dramatically. It was a huge burden on the servers and cost way too much money to run. It could potentially anger publishers. It didn't even make Instapaper into a good RSS reader. It made Instapaper into a bad RSS reader with the other features that it happened to offer. So it was a terrible feature. So I decided to remove it, and that angered a lot of people. But I still look back on that and say that was the right decision.
Yeah.
Similarly, when I removed the local search feature and replaced it with the subscription-based full archive server-side search, that was similar to what Instacash just went through, in the sense that it was, to many people, that was perceived as removing a feature and adding it back for pay for money. Even though it wasn't quite the same, it was close enough that people thought that a lot. And I got a lot of complaints about that. And I still have one-star reviews on my app, and you know, no small quantity of them, from people saying, I can't believe that search is a paid feature now. It used to be free. It was taken away. This developer is greedy, you know, corporate BS, whatever. I still have lots of bad feedback about that. And then more recently, in my 4.2.1 update that's in review right now, one or two versions ago, I added pagination boundary gestures, where if you were in pagination mode and you flipped past either the top or the bottom boundary. So if you were on page one and you said previous page, or if you're on the last page and you said next page, it would automatically close the article and go back to the list. I thought this would be a nice time-saving feature. It turns out it's just annoying. Like, I just decided it's very easy to accidentally trigger it, which I do myself, and I've heard from a lot of customers they do too. And it just, even when it's on, even when it's being used correctly, I find about half the time it triggers, I didn't want it to. Mm. And that's way too much of a failure rate. So in 4.2.1, I removed that feature. Just, it no longer does that. There's still, you can still exit the article by either swiping left when you're in scrolling mode, or by double finger swiping in any mode. You can still exit that way, or you can always, of course, hit the articles button. But it did not do well, and I think it made the app worse. So I removed it. You know, and I think that's also, I mean, of course I'm biased here, but I think that's a legitimate reason to remove a feature. If you thought it would be a good idea, but it ends up just making the app worse or annoying people too much, that's worth removing. And you know, but there's also a bad reason. And I think the bad reason to remove features is if you're doing it only to add it back in to get more money with an in-app purchase. And I don't think this was Instacast's idea. I mean, they seem like good people. Is it multiple people, or am I saying this wrong? Is it just one person?
That's a good question. I mean, I know I've talked to the one guy who runs it, but I believe that he has, you know, a small team of developers with him too. But I think they is.
Okay. So
yeah.
They, okay.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think they had negative intentions here. I really think they wanted to add these new features, and this kind of was just, it was just kind of easier to lump this in with them, the old feature.
Right.
That's my guess. But, you know, if it was a more sinister idea, you know, oh, we want to remove this and then just add it back in for more money, that's what the kind of move Zynga would make. You know?
I'm almost positive that it was not about that at all.
Yeah, I think they had good intentions here. So, you know, if you pull like a Zynga and really try to rip people off, you know, that's a bad reason to remove a feature.
Right.
What's tricky if you decide to remove a feature is you're going to get a lot of feedback about it. You're going to get a lot of negative feedback. If you have one of those rate this app dialogues that everyone loves to use so much that I really, really don't like, you're encouraging people to rate your app even if their opinion of it is negative. So if you're going to launch an update that people are not going to like for some reason, you should probably disable that dialogue for a few versions so that you aren't inviting everyone to give you a whole bunch of one-star reviews. You know, that dialogue, it really can work against you. You know, what you're just amplifying the stream of reviews, whether that's good or bad. And there's always going to be a few people who don't like it because they got annoyed by this dialogue when you asked them to. My trick, when I've removed features in the past, what I usually do is I launch the version that removes the feature, and I don't tell people to review the app. I don't solicit reviews from anybody during that version. And people will, anyway, you know, just naturally, but I don't ask. And of course, there's a whole bunch of one-star reviews, and my average review suffers for a little while. But Apple also, pretty prominently in the interface, really emphasizes the current version's reviews. So an easy trick to do is wait a couple of versions after you've added this feature that people might not like,
right?
And then ask for reviews, because by that point, your fans who love you anyway, you know, they'll go leave a review when you ask, like, hey, you know, I'd really appreciate it if you like the app to go review it, you know. And you got to use this sparingly. Like, I've asked people for reviews maybe three or four times total in 4 years. But what's good is that, you know, it kind of helps bury all those one stars a little bit, and you'll never totally get rid of them, But if you, and again, you got to use this sparingly, because if you tell people after every single update to go review the app, who cares? You know, you're crying wolf at that point. You know, you're not going to have the kind of built up goodwill that you can use here. But you know, I've done that a few times. Like after I removed the RSS folders, I waited, and then like two versions later, I said I just said on my Twitter account, the Inspire Twitter account, hey, I'd really appreciate it if you could leave a review for the app. And you know, I'm sure if you use one of those annoying dialogues, you can probably get more total reviews. But that's also an annoying dialogue, and I don't want to do that. My strategy gave me enough reviews to not totally erase the one stars from the average, but to significantly reduce their impact. So it's a good technique. Again, don't be a dick with it. Don't abuse this. Use it wisely and sparingly. And it's a decent technique to preserve your rating after you've removed a feature. All right. I think we're done with that topic. What do you think?
Yeah, I had a couple emails that came in from listeners who were saying, wow, this is really awful for Instagram. These developers are very clearly trying to address the issues that they've Instagram.
You're one of those guys?
I am. I keep
or
doing
are they?
It.
Did they say it or did you say it?
How about Instacast? Let's talk about that instead. I have emails that say everything, so we'll just skip those. With Instacast that says, look, this is, you know, it's their livelihood. There's misinformation out there. And we don't want to perpetuate that. And I think you've done an excellent job of, you know, clearing it up.
All right. So I also want to, let's see, there's my next topic. I got a big list today. I'm trying to get through it. All right. Last episode, I also talked about avoiding, when we were talking about these like RubyMotion and other frameworks that allow you to write apps in a different language than the native platform language. I got a nice question from Steve Smith. I was interested to know what your opinion was on using a framework or library such as Magical Record, which abstracts core data, or TBXML, which is an XML parsing library, instead of developing this functionality yourself. So what he's basically asking is, like, you know, I said to avoid dependencies, to avoid big dependencies, but what about these kind of medium-sized dependencies? You know, how is that?
Right.
Everyone's going to tell you something different about this. My standard and my opinion on this is that it is okay to use third-party libraries, but sparingly. And my rule here generally is, you know, I want to code my app against either things that are written by Apple that are part of the SDK, and you know, not that Apple's infallible, because they're not, and there's often bugs, but that generally their quality is very, very high on average. And chances are, if you're hitting a bug in one of Apple's frameworks, not only are there going to be a whole bunch of people on the internet telling you how to get around it, but they're probably also going to fix it pretty quickly. So, you know, relying on an Apple framework is really not that risky of a move. In many cases, you don't have a choice. So, you know, either I want to use libraries that Apple has written and provided for me, or I want to use third-party code that is small enough in scope that I can understand it and I can edit it if necessary. So, you know, I use, there was an SBJSON parser, and now with iOS 5 is native JSON, so you don't really need it anymore, but I use things like that. I use the Facebook API library for posting to Facebook, just because it's easier with the authentication and everything. I use a few things like that, but overall I use very, very little third-party code, because, you know, I want to keep things small enough that I can understand them, so that if I have to go in and fix a bug or change the way something behaves, I can, and be fairly confident that I'm not breaking something weird, you know, as a side effect. An ORM layer like Magical Record, that is not a small thing. ORM layers are very, very big and complicated, usually, because it's a very difficult problem. There's a lot to do there. That generally is not the kind of thing I would use, because that's the kind of thing, like, it would scare me to go in and try to edit my ORM layer and fix bugs in it, because they're so complicated. And that has to do with a pretty critical part of functionality of, you know, data storage and model storage and everything. Yeah. That, you know, it's one thing if your app can't post to Facebook. It's a whole other thing if your app's database gets corrupt and you don't really know how to fix it, or you hit some major performance problem that you don't really know how to work around. I don't even use Core Data, but that's, I mean, it isn't because I object to it. It's because I just don't know it and I've never needed to learn it. I don't have I don't have the kind of needs that use it. And an Instapaper's data layer predates Cordata's availability on iOS. So I had to write it first in SQLite directly. And I've just kept it that way since then. But, you know, I would really hesitate to use a third-party ORM because that's so much code. That's a lot of complication. I mean, a lot of complexity. And that's a pretty big thing to rely on. But you know, and the other thing, like an XML parsing library, that's very easy to replace. You know, you can use the built-in system stuff fairly easily. And if not, you can always use another XML parsing library. So I wouldn't worry too much about something like that. That's fairly orthogonal to your code. You can easily drop in a new one if your old one starts sucking or failing or has a major bug. But yeah, something like an ORM, generally that's so complicated and they're all a little bit different. So generally you can't drop in a replacement to an ORM layer. So again, it's about minimizing dependencies that are very difficult to replace. So that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, something like RubyMotion, that's a major dependency that's nearly impossible to replace without rewriting your entire app. So that's, you know, I avoid things like that. But things like an XML or JSON parsing library, you can replace those pretty easily. Okay, next. Do we have another sponsor to do?
Yeah, we do.
All right, I want to talk about the 15-inch MacBook Pro update.
There was a nice rumor about that gets very eerily close to some of the things that we've talked about on this very program here. So let's do it's that second sponsor. You know, Marco, more than 170,000 businesses are using this company I'm going to tell you about, which is a lot. That's a big number, don't you think? 170?
Sounds like it, yeah.
It's big. Well, they're a big company. It's Rackspace. Rackspace.com is where you go. And let me tell you, they do three things, and they do three things very, very well. They do what's called cloud hosting. You may have heard of this. This is the thing where you log in, you click a button, and boom, you have a virtual private server. It's all yours. You're ready to go. You're up and running. These things scale. You pay as you go. There's a control panel. There's an API if you want to script this thing yourself. Server, storage, load balancing, all that. They also do managed hosting, which is when guys like us think about old school hosting. You think about servers racked up in a data center.
In space.
These are things that are fully managed. You can get everything done for you, but they're physical hardware. Now, these guys, they do all the advanced server monitoring. They do monthly billing. You can predict what your costs are going to be. You can get all of that. You can get a private cloud created if you want. That is where you go in and you say, okay, I want this server running this operating system, and I want this much RAM and this many hard drives, and they actually physically configure that thing for you. But they also, Rackspace does something that nobody else does, and that's hybrid hosting. So you can get the dedicated servers for performance-intensive applications. You can get cloud servers for on-demand scaling, and these things save you money, to be honest. And then you get this cool thing they have called Rack Connect that seamlessly links both of those two environments. So you might start out and say, well, I just want a VPS. I'm launching a new service. I don't think I need very much. Great. You launch it and it starts scaling. And you say, man, it really would be nice if we had some really dedicated app servers for it. Or we want a dedicated database server. We want replication. You can do all of that and they can do it all for you. They can sit down with you and say, well, you should have this in the cloud. This is a dedicated server. Then they can make it all happen. They have fanatical support, best support in the business. Real people, phone numbers. Live chat, whatever you want to, if you don't want to use your voice, fine. They've got live chat. Whatever it is you want to do. Check these guys out, rackspace.com. Some of the best hosting in the business, and we're really thrilled to have them as an ongoing sponsor. So thanks again to Rackspace Hosting, rackspace.com.
So this morning, 9 to 5 Mac, which I think has a relatively spotty reliability record. Is that accurate?
Yes, I hate to say that because they do periodically have some stuff on there that's really great too. And it's sometimes they're really right and other times it's off the wall.
Yeah, I mean, I would say based on their track record, I would give this like a 40% chance of being right.
Okay.
But it does sound very plausible. So they posted this morning about a rumored 15-inch MacBook Pro update.
Yes.
And this has some pretty big upgrades. So we've for a while speculated that the next 15-inch MacBook Pro would be a lot like the MacBook Air.
Right.
It would adopt the wedge
has
shape.
To be.
It would drop the optical drive. It would be thinner, lighter.
How could it not be?
And you know, yeah, because the MacBook Air is an awesome computer.
Anybody,
it's just awesome.
Anybody today who says the new Apple laptop will be thinner and lighter. They're probably going to be right. But this is a big change for this particular platform, because until these rumors, they're...
By the way, I wouldn't necessarily say lighter.
Not lighter.
Well, because here's the thing. When you remove the optical drive, I know this because I removed my optical drive to put one of those hard drive bays in there, which is it's a good solution.
Right.
The optical drive weighs almost nothing. The hard drive is much heavier than it. The optical drive itself is extremely lightweight. It weighs very, very little. What weighs the most in the computer is the battery. So as long as you're keeping a relatively similar battery capacity, I don't think you can really achieve that much of a weight difference.
Okay.
So anyway, that being
said, will not be lighter.
Probably not, or at least not a lot lighter. Like, we're not going to get a 3-pound 15-inch notebook, that's for sure. Mm. Like, that's the weight of the 13-inch Air. We're not going to approach that. Right now, the current one is about 5.6 pounds or 5.5 pounds. A lot of that's from the glass screen, and I really hope they're going to drop that. I don't think it speculated on whether there's going to be glass or not. It did talk about Retina, which I'll get to in a second. The glass screen, by my estimate, because I keep buying them without the glass screens because it's so much better that way.
Yeah.
My estimate is the glass screen adds about 0.4 pounds that don't need to be there. Which that really sucks. Like, in a laptop, like, the difference between a 5.1 pound laptop and a 5.5 pound laptop is noticeable. It's not like a massive difference, but why add weight if you don't have to? Especially for something like glass, where I think a matte screen for almost every situation looks just as good, if not better. There are a few situations where it doesn't, but I think those are outnumbered by the situations where it does look better. I don't know why they have glass still, with the exception that I'm pretty sure Steve Jobs liked it a hell of a lot. One of the rumored changes here is, overall, the rumored change is that it's going to be thinner than the current one, but not wedge-shaped. They are going to drop the optical drive, supposedly, but who cares? To me, like, dropping the optical, it just doesn't matter. It's going to save space. But that's about all it's going to save. It's not going to save weight. It's not going to save costs, because they don't cost much. We're not going to really gain much from that reduction, except it'll be physically smaller. They're also dropping, supposedly, the Ethernet port, which makes sense because the Ethernet port on the current one, you can tell that that's kind of keeping it from getting any thinner, because it's almost the full height of the current case. And
we should point out that a lot of these things that are being dropped, with the exception, obviously, of the optical drive, a lot of these, including Ethernet and otherwise, are in existence and in abundance in the new display that you could get that plugs in and would connect to this with Thunderbolt.
Sure, with Thunderbolt, yeah. And one quick thing also, people are saying in response to this, oh, you can just use the USB Ethernet adapter. You can, but the current USB Ethernet adapter is only 10/100. And in practice, it doesn't really approach 100 in big file. It's more like, 10/30. It's very slow. In many cases, if you have a relatively modern wireless network, like one of these multi-in, multi-out N networks, you can usually transfer things to and from a new MacBook Air faster over the wireless network than you can with the USB Ethernet adapter. It's really terrible, because USB is terrible. The rumor here is that they're also adding USB 3.0, which, that's big. I think we haven't seen USB 3 in the Mac world yet. It's been on PCs for what, about 2 years now? It's been there for a while now.
Yeah.
USB 3, I don't know much about it because I've never had a computer that had a port for it. But it certainly does seem like what we're seeing with the fast interconnects now is very similar to what we saw a decade ago with FireWire, I don't know when FireWire 800 came out. Probably about a decade ago now, right? Anyway, FireWire was always battling with USB. Apple really wanted to push FireWire because it did it really well. And it has a number of very nice advantages over USB, but one thing it doesn't have is lower cost. And FireWire 800 continued that tradition in that 800 was much, much faster than USB 2. Still, in real-world use, FireWire 800 is the best interconnect you can use on a Mac that's not Thunderbolt today. It's getting outdated, but it never really caught on in wide use. USB 2 was far more popular because it was just, it was so much cheaper and simpler to add to things. And outside of Macs, you don't really see FireWire 800 very often on like on PCs. And I think we're seeing the same thing happen with Thunderbolt today, which is there's demand for things that are faster than FireWire 800 and USB 2. And Thunderbolt was put into Macs to help address that demand. But even though it is technically a very awesome protocol, it's very expensive to put into things. And we've seen, now Thunderbolt's been out for over a year, and we've seen almost nothing come out right. that can use it. There's very, very few Thunderbolt devices, even though every Mac, or almost every Mac that has shipped in the last year has a Thunderbolt port. And so I think what we're seeing here is the FireWire 800-ification of Thunderbolt, which is that, you know, we're going to have it in our wonderful Macs for a while, but it doesn't look like it's catching on in the industry, and it doesn't look like we're ever going to have a whole lot of peripherals for it. We're probably going to have some peripherals for it, certainly, but I don't think it's going to replace USB, and I think Apple realizes this now, too. And so that's why I think they're adding USB 3 to this rumored 15-inch MacBook Pro. You know, I think we're going to see USB 3 be implemented across the entire Mac product line, just like they kind of relented and adopted USB 2 when it was clear that FireWire 800 was not going to replace it. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, from what I know about USB 3, which, again, is very little, it seems like it, there's really no downside to replacing the USB 2 ports with USB 3 ports on other laptops. There's going to be a minor cost increase for that, but they have, you know, really good margins. They can afford to do that. I mean, there's probably higher power demands, but I assume they've thought about that and made some of that optional in the spec, and I don't know. But I think USB 3 is going to be, you know, the new USB standard in all Macs. Once they add it to the MacBook Pro, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't add it to everything else. And then there's the Retina screen. Now, it's rumored that the new 15-inch actually has a Retina screen on a Mac. It'll be the first one to have it. And that sounds a little optimistic to me. The rumor that they had it like pretty concrete. It definitely has this.
It sounds exciting to a lot of people.
Yeah, it does sound exciting. If they can do it, that's great. It sounds like we're about a year too early for that, like economically. But I don't know. I could be wrong. Apple has put off some pretty impressive things with their suppliers and what they can get. I'm curious to see how it plays out. For instance, will I prefer, if I see one of these things, even if I own one of these things, which I don't really plan to buy another 15-inch yet, but even if I own one of these things, like, would I prefer the smaller Retina screen to my giant 30-inch monitor that, you know, I assume it's going to be a long time before we have Retina 30-inch size monitors.
Yeah.
You know, will I prefer the laptop screen to it or not? You know, will bigger be better than higher quality? And I think that's going to be different for a lot of people and possibly different in different contexts, even for the same person. So that's one concern I have. My bigger concern with the Retina screen, and I've talked about this before on the show, is that as we saw with the Retina iPad, web pages that use non-Retina images look terrible on a Retina screen. It looks worse than on a non-Retina screen. So, you know, on the iPhone, it wasn't that big of a problem because it was a really small screen and it was really easy for websites to serve higher res images anyway. And a lot of websites, you weren't even really viewing at 1x anyway on the iPhone. On the iPad, it became a bigger problem because you were viewing most web pages at 1x on the iPad. And it's so much bigger than the iPhone that a lot of websites can't afford to serve giant images at 2x resolution to it because it's just way too big of a file for lots of practical and economic concerns. So that's one potential problem there. Now, when you bring that to a laptop, that problem gets exacerbated. Then you have, like, you're viewing these nice big web pages and you're running apps that are developed for Macs that have never had to have Retina graphics before. I think the adoption of Retina assets for web pages and for Mac apps is going to be much, much slower than it was for iOS devices. And, you know, Mac apps will do it first because those developers are more likely to care and to be in this mode of keeping up with Apple. But websites are still extremely slow to update. And part of the reason why is that, as we've said before, there's still really no good way to do it in HTML. There's a couple of bad ways to do it. The best way to do it is with the media query in CSS and do background images, but then it doesn't work with the image tag, and there's a few places where you can't really do that practically. And so it's not, there's still no great solution for this yet, and so most web page authors aren't doing it. And also, web page markup takes a long time to change, you know, across the industry. Anyone who's worked in web standards knows it takes a while before these things really catch on, and before a lot of browsers even have support for them and everything else. So there's really no, I have no reason to believe that web page authors and creators are going to adopt Retina graphics quickly. So if you buy one of these new MacBook Pros with a Retina screen, if this thing is real, I think you're going to have quite a long time of looking at bad-looking web pages before people finally catch up.
Right.
You know, and again, like a non-Retina graphic on a Retina screen looks worse than that same graphic on a non-Retina screen. So I don't know if I'd want to own something, to own a computer that renders web pages that look worse almost all the time than the computer I had before, even though it makes everything else look better. Because I view a lot of web pages, and a lot of people do. That's a pretty common task for computers these days. It's going to be a while before everything looks better, or even before most things look better on a Retina Mac. So that's the only thing that would give me pause before buying one, is thinking about that concern, thinking, you know, maybe I don't actually want that. But I guess I'll see when the opportunity presents itself. I'll see how what I think about it then, once I actually see one of these things and see how apps look on it, and how text looks on it, you know. But it's certainly not as much of a no-brainer as it was on the iOS devices. And again, I think there's going to be it's going to be a long time before big desktop size displays can be had in Retina resolutions.
So you're gonna call foul on that?
Not foul, just kind of a like a shrug. You know, I'm gonna call shrug on that. Like, I don't know if that's necessarily gonna be good at first. Now, I think that's definitely where the industry is going. I'm sure eventually this will be great, but it might be a few years before things on average look better on the Retina screen.
Yeah.
Just because it's going to take a while for people to update their stuff, and especially web pages. That's going to take the longest. So I think that's it. I have a big topic that I'll save for next week.
You about sure? Design.
Oh, yeah. I can't do it now. I'm too tired.
All right. Well, it is tiring.
It is, yep.
How's that kid? How's the baby?
Pretty good. Yeah, you want to make that after dark?
Yeah, we can do that after dark. Yeah, all right, so thanks everybody for tuning in. If you were following along or you'd like to follow along for this show or in the future, you can go to 5by5.tv/buildanalyze/77 because this is the 77th episode. And you'll see all of the show notes and links and everything else that's there. That's sponsored by HelpSpot.com, and they have decided to give $100 off if you want to go over to their site and create your own help desk solution. $100 off. Use the code 5by5 for that. And you can follow Marco on Twitter. He is at Marco Arment. And did you see that? There's a little reference to the...
Yeah, okay. That, yeah.
And I'm Dan Benjamin on Twitter and Instapaper, but we don't say .com. And go get the new 5by5 app. Go get the 5x5 radio. There's a big link. If you go to 5x5.tv, it's on all the pages. You can see it there. You can just search for 5x5 radio in the iTunes store. And we love you. Thank you for doing that. Thanks for helping make it a success. And have a great week. Thank you, Marco.
Thanks, Dan.